From Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship, this is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, October 22, 2003. From WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. The Senate joins the House in passing a bill that will ban abortions after 12 weeks of pregnancy. Ahead of tomorrow's International Donor Conference for Iraq, only the US, Japan and Italy have confirmed they'll send foreign ministers. And it's 2 years since Mexican human rights attorney Digna Ochoa was killed. Human rights groups decry the lack of investigation into her death. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Chevron Texaco is in an Ecuadorian court today facing a $1 billion lawsuit. The trial, brought on behalf of 30,000 indigenous Ecuadorians, accuses the company of polluting the country's rainforest and water resources. Plaintiffs also say the company's activities led to an increased risk of cancer among the local population. Shannon Wright is with Amazon Watch. She says that scientific studies prove that toxicity levels of carcinogens are still excessive. She explains what the outcome of this case means to other large businesses operating in developing nations.
What it will mean for groups working to protect the environment and for indigenous peoples working to protect their land is that U.S. corporations operating overseas can be held and will be held accountable in foreign courts. Importantly, a U.S. judge in a Second Circuit court has said that any decision taken in Ecuador will be enforced here in the U.S. because this is where Chevron Texaco's assets lie.
Chevron Texaco says it paid some $40 million to clean up the mess and has that agreement in writing with the Ecuadorian government. President George W. Bush arrived in Australia for a 21-hour visit amid protests and the largest security operation ever mounted in Australia's capital. As Free Speech Radio News correspondent Guy Deegan reports, President Bush will meet with Australia's Prime Minister John Howard and is expected to formally thank Australia for its supporting role in the war against Iraq.
Though regarded largely as a symbolic visit ahead of free trade talks with Australia, President Bush will address a special joint session of Australia's Parliament tomorrow, which has been recalled at a cost of up to $2 million Australian dollars. Despite large public exclusion zones, thousands of anti-Bush protesters are expected outside Parliament House during the President's visit. Meanwhile, in order to draw President Bush's attention to the plight of the two Australians currently detained in Camp X-Ray at Guantanamo Bay, the Greens Party will invite the wife and son of Mamdu Habib and the lawyer of David Hicks to watch the President's address from the public gallery inside Parliament House. Greens Party leader Senator Bob Brown has also slammed the closing of the parliamentary precinct to the public at the insistence of the US Secret Service, a move that will hinder protests. President Bush's visit follows this week's APEC summit in Bangkok and coincides with an official state visit to Australia by China's President Hu Jintao. In Sydney, Australia, I'm Guy Deegan for Free Speech Radio News.
The spate of Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip Monday has sparked condemnation because of the large number of civilian casualties. The Israeli Air Force carried out 5 airstrikes in the Gaza Strip, killing 12 Palestinians. Mohammed Galyini is in Gaza.
Most of the dead were civilian bystanders. The deadliest raid happened on Monday night when an Israeli attack helicopter fired several missiles at the car of resistance activists at the entrance to the Al-Nusayrat refugee camp. The second missile struck after bystanders had massed around the car to aid the occupants. This killed at least 7 civilians, including a physician and a 12-year-old boy. 100 other people were wounded. According to Israeli military sources, the strikes were in response to the firing by Palestinian activists of crude Qassam missiles at towns inside the Israeli Green Line. The large number of civilian deaths sparked debate within Israel itself. Ofer Paniz, the Secretary General of the Opposition Labour Party, said the attacks showed that the Israeli government was, quote, losing its mind. Meanwhile, Israel has decided to continue building the separation wall inside the occupied West Bank, despite a UN General Assembly resolution declaring the wall illegal and calling for the dismantling of the built-up sections. For FSRN in Gaza, I'm Mohammed Ghalayini.
Human Rights Watch released a report today indicting the United States prison system for becoming a repository for the nation's mentally ill. From Pacifica Station WBAI in New York City, Jackson Allers reports.
According to the Human Rights Watch report, about 300,000 inmates, or 15% of the estimated 2 million men and women locked up in U.S. prisons, suffer from mental disorders like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and major depression. The 215-page report concludes U.S. prisons are dangerous places for the mentally ill, in part because there is a shortage of qualified staff and a lack of mental health facilities. The Human Rights Watch report also concludes that the percentage of imprisoned women who are mentally ill is considerably higher than that of men, as much as 2 times higher, according to a similar Justice Department study conducted in 1999. Meanwhile, 2 U.S. lawmakers from Ohio, Republican Senator Mike DeWine and Democratic Congressman Ted Strickland, have authored a bill that would provide federal grants to divert mentally ill offenders into treatment programs rather than jail or prison, and improve the quality of mental health services provided to jail and prison inmates. From Pacifica Station WBAI in New York City, I'm Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
In the first major decision in 30 years that will seriously limit a woman's right to choose to have an abortion, yesterday the Senate gave final approval to a bill to prohibit late-term abortions. President Bush, who is visiting Asia, said he looked forward to signing the bill on his return. We're joined now by Priscilla Smith of the Center for Reproductive Rights. Priscilla, firstly, there is much confusion over what Congress has actually banned. Some call it partial birth abortion, some call it late-term abortion. How do we understand this new legislation?
The most important thing for Americans to know is that this has nothing to do with late-term abortion or one particular procedure. This bill will ban most of the safe procedures used to terminate pregnancies as early as 12 weeks, and that's a full month before amniocentesis is even performed. So women who are obtaining abortions starting early in the second trimester would either not be able to obtain an abortion at all or would be subjected to increased risks.
The Bush administration started their attack on women's rights globally the first day it came into power. How set in stone is this? Can this be reversed? Bush obviously hasn't signed it yet, but he will.
Yes, President Bush has pledged to sign this bill and has been asking Congress to pass the bill. But we will seek immediate injunctive relief against the bill as soon as it is signed. And we're quite confident we'll get injunction. And that's because the same issue went to the Supreme Court just 3 years ago, and a very similar statute was struck down. And this statute is unconstitutional for the same 2 reasons that that bill was.
And what are those reasons?
Well, first of all, it is such a broad ban on second trimester abortions. It bans the safest procedures used, as I said, as early as 12 weeks in pregnancy. And the Supreme Court said that that's unconstitutional. That poses an undue burden on women because it does subject them to increased risks. And second, this bill also bans any exception for a woman's health where the procedures banned would be the safest ones performed. And the Supreme Court also said that is unacceptable. So this bill fails for the same 2 reasons that the Nebraska bill did.
Now, this has passed Congress in the past, but President Clinton has vetoed it twice. Under the Bush administration, a whole nother story. If this fails in court, what then?
Well, if this fails in court, that will mean that there has been a change in the composition of the Supreme Court. And if that's true, then the right to abortion is seriously imperiled in this country. I seriously hope that that will not happen, but that's obviously always a possibility. And in fact, that's the reason that this bill is being passed. The antis are hoping for a change in the composition of the Supreme Court to overturn the Carhart case and Roe versus Wade.
So weeding through some of the confusion that we've just been talking about, what does this look like for a woman who may need to have an abortion for whatever reason? How does this affect her as of today?
Well, a woman who goes to obtain an abortion after 12 weeks in pregnancy is either not going to be able to obtain an abortion if no injunction is granted, or will have to obtain an abortion with higher risks to her own health. Those risks could include infertility, infection, and even death. The procedures that are being banned today are responsible for an enormous decrease in those risks to women. And if they're banned, obviously those risks come back.
Just finally, what about a doctor? What's their position now, especially abortion providers?
Abortion providers who perform second trimester abortions using these safe and common methods are at risk of prosecution from Attorney General John Ashcroft, who himself is on record as being anti-abortion. So those abortion providers need to ensure that they're protected by one of the cases that will be going forward.
Priscilla Smith with the Center for Reproductive Rights, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
In Congress today, Senate Republicans failed to break a Democratic filibuster over a measure to alter the rules of class action lawsuits. The Republican-backed measure would take interstate class action lawsuits out of state courts and into federal courts, which are considered to be more favorable to business. This is the Congressional Accounting Office reports that offshore tax shelters created by large corporations have cost the U.S. government $85 billion. In a Senate hearing, former corporate employees said that the offshore tax shelters in no way benefit the economy and that they're purely motivated by greed. Mitch Jeserich has more from Capitol Hill.
Already passed by the House, Republican congressional members are pushing a bill to take class action lawsuits out of a state court if the business being sued is incorporated in another state, and put the case in a federal court. So far, Democrats have been able to block a vote in the Senate. Democratic Senator John Breaux represents Louisiana.
But we don't reach out and say that even if every single injured party was from one state and was injured in violation of the state laws passed by the state legislature and previously interpreted by the state Supreme Court, that just because a defendant happens to be incorporated in the state of Delaware, for instance, that that somehow yanks that case out of state court, which is best suited for interpreting state law.
Opponents to the measure say that federal courts are more likely to be lenient to businesses and hand down smaller settlements. Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas says, however, that the bill is needed not because of the size of corporate settlements, but because of lawyers.
But we're not in the business of making sure that a few benefit at the expense of many. And that's what happens now with an abusive class action system, which enriches entrepreneurial class lawyers who find a so-called class representative and are then able to manufacture a huge lawsuit where they reap millions of dollars in fees and the consumer gets a coupon.
While the debate continues, former employees from the financial industry have testified in a Senate hearing that some of the country's largest corporations are maliciously avoiding paying corporate taxes. During the hearing on Tuesday, Mr. Janet, whose name and voice was changed to protect his identity, says large corporations are leasing and then releasing phony transactions with public municipalities in Europe and the United States. He says such municipalities include the subway systems of Chicago, Boston, and Washington, D.C. He says this allows corporations to avoid paying billions of dollars in taxes.
The sole purpose of this scheme is to generate a tax shelter for U.S. corporations that invest in these schemes. These structures are about the greed of senior management of large U.S. corporations and their financial advisors. The intent is to steal money just like a bank robber.
A congressional report suggests the U.S. Treasury has lost $85 billion in corporate taxes as many companies set up businesses overseas in paper only. Called offshore tax shelters, these allow companies to avoid paying U.S. taxes. Many corporate tax avoidance schemes are legal, however, and for those that are not, the IRS says it's too underfunded to go after corporate tax evaders and outgunned by corporate lawyers. Offshore tax shelters have been reported on now for over 2 years, but Washington has yet to act. Lee Drutman with Citizen Works doesn't expect reform anytime soon.
Perhaps there's a chance that some public momentum will build, and as the federal budget goes further and further into a massive deficit, there'll be a need to collect revenue, and certainly this is a place where there's a lot of lost revenue. So I think there's hope that this will lead to more reform, but I wouldn't hold my breath given who's in power in Washington.
Senate Finance Committee Chair Charles Grassley has a proposal to recapture about $13 billion over the next 10 years from corporations, even though it is estimated that corporations get away with about $20 billion a year. The financial industry has generously made monetary contributions to Grassley's campaign, including Ernst & Young, the accounting firm accused of encouraging companies to open offshore tax shelters. Other companies accused of such schemes include two of the world's largest banks, Bank of America and Citigroup. Other companies include military contractors such as Boeing and Halliburton. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jeserich on Capitol Hill.
Representatives from dozens of countries will converge on Madrid tomorrow for a two-day conference aimed at raising money to rebuild Iraq. So far, $2 to $3 billion has been pledged, in addition to the $20 billion the Bush administration plans to contribute, well short of Iraq's estimated needs. Apart from Spain, which is hosting the gathering, only the US, Japan and Italy have confirmed they will send foreign ministers to the conference, a sign, some say, that many governments are reluctant to help foot the bill for the US-led invasion. Susan Wood has more from the United Nations.
The World Bank and the United Nations estimate that rebuilding Iraq's economy will cost $36 billion over the next 4 years. U.S. and Spanish officials are hedging their bets on pledges at this week's conference. Secretary of State Colin Powell said Sunday the U.S. would take as much money as it could get. But while expectations may be lower, the stakes for the Bush administration remain high, says Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies.
The domestic pressures are mounting, both from the vantage point of the continuing attacks on U.S. troops, and certainly the economic cost of this war, the $87 billion that was just allocated at a time of huge tax credits only for the richest Americans and enormous cutbacks in social spending.
The Bush administration had hoped last week's unanimous approval of a UN Security Council resolution recognizing the legitimacy of the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council would persuade other countries to send troops or money. However, Security Council members France, Russia, and Germany stated immediately after the vote that they could not consider any further military or financial commitments absent a greater political role for the UN and a clearer timetable for restoring Iraqi sovereignty. Michael Renner is a senior researcher at the World Watch Institute.
Bush can go around and say, hey, you know, I have a unanimous United Nations Security Council resolution here. But it just may not really make any difference. And I think the not making any difference made it easier for these countries to say, hey, you know, let's vote for it, you know, let's not even bother abstaining.
The European Union has pledged just $233 million and is insisting, along with Japan and other potential donors, on the money being administered by a fund separate from the American-run Development Fund for Iraq. A report prepared earlier this month by the Open Society Institute's Iraq Revenue Watch criticizes the fund's lack of transparency. According to an unnamed Security Council diplomat quoted in the report, $1 billion from the UN Oil for Food program went into the fund since May, and those dollars have disappeared. Again, Phyllis Bennis.
Have they been spent? If so, on what? Under whose authority? It's not clear if Paul Bremer is simply spending that money as if it was his own personal account that he can provide to whatever Iraqi projects he chooses. And there's a great deal of concern about that.
Questions are also being raised closer to home. President Bush today threatened to veto his own spending bill for Iraq and Afghanistan if Iraq has to pay back any of the money. The Senate version of the bill, backed by the House of Representatives, would make half of Bush's $20 billion rebuilding request a loan, unless Iraq's mainly European creditors forgive the debt incurred by Saddam Hussein. Rania Masri, a spokesperson for the Campaign to Stop the War Profiteers, says Congress is aiming at the wrong target.
Legally speaking, it is the United States' responsibility to rebuild Iraq, to rebuild what has been destroyed, both as the party that bombed Iraq and right now as the occupying party. It is not the U.S.'s responsibility, though, to use U.S. taxpayer money and Iraqi oil profits in order to benefit U.S. corporations who are barely doing that job and promising to do it at an exorbitantly high price.
Last week, Iraq's new privatization chief, Thomas Foley, said he would begin selling off some of Iraq's 200 state-owned enterprises. The Iraqi Governing Council recently announced sweeping free market reforms that will allow 100% foreign ownership of Iraqi firms, except those in the oil sector. The announcement came in September, but was planned long before, according to Adam Horowitz, a New York University graduate student and co-founder of a project called Reconstruction Tracker.
As early as May, reports started coming out regarding the plans for a mass privatization program, which is actually the name that the U.S. government was giving it, concerning both the actual selling off of Iraqi state-owned industries, but also the reworking of Iraqi law to make that possible.
Many legal experts say Article 47 of the Fourth Geneva Convention outlaws changes in an occupied territory's economic system. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Yesterday, Florida Governor Jeb Bush signed into law an emergency bill designed to reinsert a feeding tube into Terri Schiavo, the brain-damaged Florida woman who's been comatose for the past 13 years. The move came 6 days after that feeding tube had been finally removed, a move that Michael Schiavo, Terri Schiavo's husband, has sought since 1998, testifying that she told him she would never want to be kept alive artificially. But her parents have fought Michael Schiavo every step of the way, exhausting their legal options only last week. But some observers worry that yesterday's bill, signed by Governor Bush and approved by the heavily Republican state legislature, is a serious breach of the separation of powers between the legislature and the courts. Mitch Perry from community affiliate WMNF in Tampa has more.
Beginning in the days leading up to the feeding tube being removed from Terri Schiavo last week, dozens of advocates for keeping Schiavo on life support, some from all over the country, descended to the hospice where she has been staying in Pinellas Park, Florida, lobbying Governor Bush to intervene to keep her alive. Amy Neilton traveled from Tennessee to join the vigil last Thursday. She said she wasn't going to leave until the governor acted.
And I have worked with many patients in her condition and, you know, that couldn't speak or really openly communicate. But I laughed with those people and loved with those people, and their spirit just shone from their eyes. And that's the situation she's in, you know, and it's obvious from the people that know her and have visited with her in the past. And she does have a life, and she has a quality of life. And it's, I just feel like it's not our place to take that from her.
Many of those protesting support of keeping Terri Schiavo alive are angry at her husband for not fighting to keep her alive as well, such as Iris Peskis.
I look at it this way. If I starved my cat or my child, I'd go to jail. And I think it's very unfair to starve her, considering it's not like she's on a ventilator for air. She just needs food to eat.
Politics of the conservative stripe have also played some part in this week's actions. 2 weeks ago, Governor Bush called in the state legislature to the state capitol for one reason only. That was to discuss and approve an unprecedented amount of funding to bring in a biomedical research technology medical facility from California. But on Sunday night, Florida House Speaker Johnny Byrd, an arch-conservative running for the GOP nomination for U.S. Senate next year, announced he was structuring a bill that would deal with keeping Terri Schiavo alive. The Senate bill was actually written by yet another GOP candidate for senator next year, Daniel Webster, who admitted yesterday that the legislature was perhaps going beyond their purview.
And are we pushing the envelope? Absolutely we are. And in this particular case, for me personally, this is a time where the envelope needs to be stretched a little bit.
George Filos is the attorney representing Michael Schiavo. He bristled yesterday afternoon when he learned that the legislature and the governor were intervening.
They say the governor knows best. He will decide for her. We should all be outraged. Every court, all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, resisted the political pressure the Schindlers and their supporters placed on them to ignore Terry's medical condition and her wishes. The fight is no longer about Terry. It's about the rights of every one of us to control our own lives. It's about whether your choices will be honored through the courts of this land. It's about whether the governor and the legislature have the right to tell you what your medical treatment decision should be.
University of Florida law professor Lars Noah specializes in medical technology. He said the law passed in the Florida legislature in near record time is unconstitutional.
Now, the appropriate response, I think, by a state legislature would be to enact a new law amending existing rules in this state. But what's so unusual in this case is that they chose not to do that and instead chose only to intervene in this particular instance that they just can't stomach.
Terri Schiavo is now receiving treatment at Morton Plant Hospital in Clearwater. There has not been any new legal challenge yet, but that is expected to come from Michael Schiavo's attorneys at any time. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
This past weekend marked the second anniversary of the unresolved death of Mexican human rights attorney Digna Ochoa. The lawyer, who handled some of the most politically sensitive cases in Mexico, was found dead in her office from a gunshot wound to the back of the head 2 years ago. Regardless of the fact that Ochoa began receiving death threats as early as 1995 and had survived two kidnappings and one attempted murder, her assassination has been ruled a suicide by government investigators. This week, the Inter-American Human Rights Commission began reviewing her case. From Mexico City, Vladimir Flores has this report.
As an attorney, Digna Ochoa y Plácido defended a spectrum of political prisoners, including presumed Zapatistas, student strikers, and ecological activists. When Ochoa was found shot in her Mexico City office in October of 2001, the national and international human rights community was shocked. When her execution-style death was ruled as a suicide, civil society reacted with disgust. The Mexican Attorney General accepted the suicide theory, thereby closing the case. With the options eliminated, Digna's brother, Jesus Ochoa, will take the case to the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights in Washington.
Vamos a entregarle a la...
We're going to bring the Inter-American Commission copies of items to show that what happened to Digna was a crime. They are items that Mexican jurisprudence has thrown out on two occasions already. Since Mexico is part of the Inter-American Commission, they can make recommendations and demand that the case not be closed and that they open all of the lines of investigation, now that the Mexican justice system has been wanting to close the case since last year.
On August 6th, human rights defender Griselda Tirado was assassinated. Tirado worked in the indigenous region of Huehuetla in southern Mexico. Amnesty International called on President Fox to demonstrate an effective commitment in the defense of the human rights in the country. Jesús Ochoa talked about the actual situation of the attacks to the defense of human rights.
El hostigamiento contra defensores de derechos humanos en México.
The harassment against human rights defenders in Mexico really hasn't disappeared. To the contrary, inside of the Fox government, the circumstances remain the same, or even worse than that of previous governments. As a state policy, we think that behind all this there are governmental interests to silence the voices of human rights defenders.
Over the course of 10 years, Digna Ochoa attended legal cases involving the Mexican army. On several occasions, she received death threats and was even kidnapped. The general of the Mexican army, Francisco Gallardo, talked about the army's participation on death of Digna Ochoa. General Gallardo was 8 years in prison to propose the creation of a military ombudsman.
Bueno, yo creo que es una línea de...
Well, I think it's a line of investigation that hasn't been exhausted. The majority of the cases that Digna Ochoa worked on had to do with the Army. It's completely illogical that they're not looking into this. I think that, yes, there must have been an intervention by the Army.
Another case considered serious by Amnesty International is the one of Alfonso Martín del Campo, who was tortured in 92 by 12th Judicial Police in Mexico City to declare it guilty of a double murder, and whose case shows the force of the torture as a way to obtain confessions of the defendants. Janet Martinez is the wife of Alfonso Martín and talk about the memory of Digna Ochoa.
It's an example of struggle. It's also an example, sadly, of injustice, no? Because of what they did. Professor Ochoa and I are united by our pain. We're united by our struggle and by our drive to see justice done. We're going to keep walking together to find justice, because we don't want anything less. We're not looking for anything that doesn't live up to the law.
From Mexico City, I am Vladimir Flores for Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.